You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. My guest today needs no introduction. From movies like The Birdcage to animated classics like The Lion King to Broadway shows like The Producers, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, and Angels in America, Nathan Lane has been hailed as one of the great entertainers of our time. Now he stars as a cynical detective in 1930s Los Angeles in the television series Penny Dreadful, City of Angels, which premieres on Showtime this Sunday at 10 p.m. Eastern. And today, I'm thrilled to finally welcome Nathan to the podcast. He talks about why his fans always think he's Jewish, how his older brother inspired him to get into acting, and some of the roles he's played on Broadway in shows like Guys and Dolls, The Iceman Cometh, and of course, The Producers. Then Nathan takes a call from Tony Award-winning actor-director Joe Mantello on the podcast, shares that he's finally close to realizing their dream of working together in a revival of Death of a Salesman, and laments the lasting impact that the coronavirus could have on Broadway theater. He discusses starring in the return of Showtime's hit series Penny Dreadful, how the new season transports the show from Victorian London to California on the cusp of World War II, and what it's like to finally star in something where he gets an actual stunt double. He reveals his own love for the noir detective fiction of Raymond Chandler, how Penny Dreadful exposes the social tensions simmering under the surface of 1930s LA, and how his character was partly inspired by a real attorney turned Nazi hunter who was determined to stop Hitler's nefarious plans for Los Angeles. Plus, Nathan remembers the late playwright Terrence McNally, George C. Scott does Noel Coward, and the grueling experience of working with 80s TV magician Doug Henning in the notorious Broadway musical flop Merlin. Coming up with Nathan Lane in just a moment. Folks, you know Nathan Lane from his many starring roles in film and television, including American Crime Story, The People vs. O.J. Simpson, Ironweed, The Birdcage, Frankie and Johnny, Mouse Hunt, Jeffrey, Nicholas Nickleby, and The Lion King. All of that is to say nothing of an already legendary career on the Broadway stage, which has earned him 6 Tony nominations and 3 Tony wins for his performances in The Producers, Angels in America, and A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. Indeed, in 2010, the New York Times described him as the greatest stage entertainer of the decade. But for my money, he's probably the greatest stage entertainer of this or any other decade. Now he's starring as a hard-boiled detective in 1930s Los Angeles in the new season of Showtime's Penny Dreadful. Penny Dreadful, City of Angels premieres Sunday, April 26th at 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific. Nathan Lane, welcome.
Well, Ben, thank you. That is quite an introduction. I'm impressed.
I'm impressed. You're impressed.
My own career and for your kindness and generosity. Thank you very much.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I've been a fan of yours for years, and I've seen you on stage so many times. But I have to say, I just got the shock of my life just before this interview, Nathan, when I learned that you are not the nice Jewish boy that I always thought you were. Turns out you're a nice Irish Catholic boy.
Well, I'm not anymore, but I'm a nice atheist boy.
Yeah.
But I gave up Catholicism a long time ago. But yes, I know. Often, I think because of the first name, Nathan, people do think I'm Jewish, or have, at least in the past. My real name is Jolene, and I changed it to Nathan way back when, many years ago, when there was already a Joseph Lane in Actors Equity. So they asked me to, you know, just choose another name, which was in the moment was traumatic. But I wound up picking the name of Nathan because I had played Nathan Detroit in a non-equity dinner theater production of Guys and Dolls. And
course, was the production that you're very well known for, right?
That's right. It was a big hit in Cedar Grove, New Jersey at the time. And I was a very young 21-year-old Nathan Detroit. So I was very fond of that character in that show. So I just said, I'll be Nathan Lane. And so, yes, many people have I think, gotten the wrong idea that I was. I had actually changed my last name from Berkowitz to Lane. But I'm sort of, I would like to think I'm an unofficial honorary Jew. When it comes to stage and screen appearance.
Yeah, I honestly, in my personal interactions over the years, I don't think I've ever known a Nathan who wasn't Jewish.
No, I wasn't really thinking about any of that. I just liked the name and the character. So I didn't think of all of the religious repercussions or that, yes, for years, I think, people thought I was Jewish, which is nice. At least it means they believed who I was playing. It felt it was authentic. So that is very gratifying.
Yeah. So it's not just me. You get that a lot. Do you get old Jewish moms coming up and wanting to pinch your cheeks or something?
Yes, sure. It's a big demographic for me. But
you and Barbara.
I remember a lady after what I did Guys and Dolls eventually on Broadway at this 1992 production that was very celebrated. And I do remember coming out after a show and there was a little old Jewish lady who said to me, you were wonderful. And I said, well, thank you very much. She said, and I saw Sam Levine. And I said, oh, was I better than Sam Levine? And she said, well, come on. He was Sam Levine. I didn't quite equal Sam Levine, but what are you going to do? He was one of the greats. They wrote that part for him.
Oh, yeah.
And then only discovered afterwards that Sam couldn't sing. I mean, at all. Which is why Nathan Detroit doesn't have any songs in that show, except for the duet of Sue Me.
Yeah, I mean, Guys and Dolls has a strange history of actors who couldn't sing. Makes me think of the horrible Brando version in the movie, you know?
Oh, well, that was, you know, that story, the famous story of they came to, was it Abe Burrows and Frank Lesser? And they said, it was Sam Goldwyn who said, I have very exciting news. We got Frank Sinatra to be in the movie of Guys and Dolls. And they said, oh, that's fantastic. He'll be wonderful as Skye Masterson. And he said, no. Marlon Brando is going to be Skye Masterson. Frank Sinatra is going to play Nathan Detroit. And they said, oh, well, you know, Sam, you know, it was written for Sam Levine, and we really hoped he could recreate his role in the film. And he said, Sam Levine, no, too Jewish. Can't believe the entire conversation is centering around being Jewish. But here we are. we're in quarantine.
Yeah, exactly.
We can talk about anything we want. Don't you find that now, because of this, there's a kind of I don't know what you would call it, a pandemic candor, sort of an end of the world. Like, what do I give a crap anymore? Yeah. I'm going to say whatever I feel, somewhere hovering between suicidal and homicidal. You'll just say anything that you ordinarily we wouldn't be talking.
Yeah.
Such a fashion, but
we have all turned into Donald Trump in his pajamas, I think.
Oh no, it's not that bad.
Okay, well, you mentioned Frank Lesser, the composer of Guys and Dolls, and I'm curious, when you did Guys and Dolls, did you ever meet the widow, Jo Lesser? She was a tough old bird, wasn't she?
She was very kind to me. She was a lovely lady. And she was, I'm sure she was tough when it came to people asking for the rights to things, and because she was very protective of Frank's legacy. And of course, she had starred in Most Happy Fella.
Yeah.
That's how they met. I'm trying to think of the...
Are you trying to think of the quote? I forget. Well,
the story of, his first wife, who was, who actually was a rather difficult person.
Oh, really?
And she was known as the evil of two lessers.
Oh, okay. Yes. I was thinking of that quote. Yeah.
But that's what came to mind. But no, Jo Lesser, I was very fond of, and she was very sweet to me. And she, I know how much she loved that, that revival.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, Nathan, I feel like I am a committed Nathan Lane fan going way back, and I don't think I even realized it till I started thinking about it today, just how many times I have seen you on the stage, probably even more than in your TV and films, which is saying a lot. I have such great memories of you in Forum, Laughter on the 23rd Floor, The Odd Couple, Angels in America, The Iceman Cometh, of course, The Producers.
Wow.
I mean, of all of the great Broadway shows that you were in, what was the happiest that you've ever been on stage?
Thank you very much for having gone to see all those shows. That's hard to say, because there's I love being on stage. There are different kinds of moments that you remember in things like The Producers or Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, when people are just roaring with laughter and you're writing the waves of laughter, and it's thrilling when you have great material like that. And then you remember the moments of silence in certainly in the plays of Terrence McNally, or in Iceman Cometh, where you can feel the audience so intently listening and feeling whatever is happening, and there's a kind of silence that you can only hear in the theater, and where you're all connected, and you feel when you're really in it. And those times that it doesn't happen every night. Every night is not magical, but there are those moments when it all comes together, and it's sort of the reason why you keep going back to the theater, to keep experiencing that connection with an audience. Why it's so difficult now with everything closed down and the fear of people gathering again. It's a scary moment, because we don't know what the ending of this movie is.
That's been another victim of the coronavirus, the fact that Broadway theaters, they've been dark for, I think, over a month now. A lot of actors, musicians, and crew out of work. Producers must be hemorrhaging money. I don't know if insurance covers something like this. Do you think Broadway can recover from this?
Nobody knows. That's what's so scary about all of this. The unknown. We don't know. And I try to be optimistic. And then I also think somehow, I don't think everything is going to be quite the same after this, at least until there's a vaccine and people feel confident again to gather in a large group. It's not just theater, obviously. It's opera, ballet, classical, music, concerts, any performances, sports. It's difficult. The audience is a key part of the event. They are the other, in a sense, another actor in the evening. And so, it's a devastating thing. And obviously, financially, people, are struggling. And you just hope the government will will help continue, you know, to help in these situations. With the, you know, people in the arts are thought of last. And right. And God knows,
especially
you
these
know,
days.
Yeah, and you want to obviously, you know, help the people who really need it the most. But it's, you know, this is devastating to so many.
Yeah.
The horrifying part is we don't know what's going to happen. But, you know, I hope that we can all come out of this for the better. And that something about this is going to bring people together. That we have to, we all have to work together to help each other, to protect each other in a situation like this. And maybe, you know, at a time when we're famously so divided and people don't listen to one another, maybe something like this will shake things up and change that.
Well, on a lighter note, I loved you in The Producers.
No. Thanks.
I was actually there the last preview before opening night. How many times have you played a role originated by Zero Mostel?
That one.
And the Forum.
And funny thing happened on the way to the Forum. Was there another one?
In my mind's eye, it's the weirdest thing. I was thinking about this earlier. I could swear that I saw you in a production of Rhinoceros.
No.
But now that I think about it, I don't think you were ever in that production. So I don't know what I'm thinking.
I love that play, but it would be an interesting thing to revive. I don't know whether there were some. I was asked to do Fiddler once. Oh. I think I was asked. They did a production that Alfred Molina starred in, originated in. And then when he left, they asked me if I would take over, and I said no. Huh. You know, that I just thought, I think that's where I draw the line in terms of Zero Mostel roles and, you know, the Jewish equation. And I just thought, no, I think I'm going to leave that alone. Obviously, it's a great part. Yeah. But,
Oh,
look. I'm getting a call.
Oh, this is exciting. Who calls
Nathan Lane at 1:00? Ben, should I answer it?
Sure, why not?
Hello? Joe, I'm in the middle of a podcast with Ben Mathis. Have you heard of Ben Mathis? You've not? Well, you're in for a treat because he's a delight. And he's a big theater fan, so this is Joe Mantello.
Oh, I thought it was Joe Lesser. The
director, no, Joe Lesser. No, she's no longer with us. So, I will call you back when I'm done. All right, thanks, Joe. Bye. Joe said bye.
Okay, well, that's very nice. I have to ask, you have played so many iconic roles on stage. Is there a role in the pantheon of Broadway classics that you're still dying to play on stage at some point?
Well, Willie Loman.
Oh, yeah.
And that's been in the works for a while.
Wow.
Trying to work out schedules and Joe Mantello. Funny you should bring this up. Joe Mantello and I have talked about this for years, going back to when we did Love, Valor, Compassion together when we were just children. And he said to me one day while we were rehearsing, someday you and I are going to do Death of a Salesman. And now finally, Scott Rudin, who's would be producing, there have been many issues because of scheduling and possible writer strikes and actor strikes and the television series schedules. And now, of course, because of this, everything has changed and is up in the air. But
That would be great. I would love to see you in that.
Yes. Joe and I have been talking about this for years. And so I think it could happen if show business ever opens again.
Yeah. You know, I think I would like to see you in The King and I.
The King and I.
Yeah, it's a puzzlement.
Oh, the Jewish King and I.
Yeah, exactly.
The King of what? Of
the
Israel?
King of the Jews. I don't know.
The King of the Jews. Well, that's a whole other story. That's the, yes. I Well, Ben, I don't even know what to say to that. No, I think there would be an uproar if I played that king. I did play, yes, the King of Broadway, and it was a spectacular time.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more when we come back in just a minute. This ad is a warning. Our democracy is under attack from the U.S. Supreme Court. In the middle of a deadly global pandemic, people across Wisconsin were planning on voting absentee to keep themselves and their families safe. But the night before the election, five Republican justices on the Supreme Court told thousands of people they would have to choose between risking their lives and forfeiting their right to vote. This Supreme Court favoring Republican interests over our democracy is nothing new. They gutted the Voting Rights Act. They invited billionaires and corporations to spend unlimited amounts trying to influence elections. They gave a green light to gerrymandering, voter ID laws, and voter roll purges. Now, a progressive movement is rising up to fight back. Because it's quite possible the Wisconsin case won't be the last 2020 showdown over voting rights to be settled in the courts. And we simply can't trust this court to put aside partisan views and protect people's right to vote. Our courts are becoming too political. It's time to say enough. Learn more about how you can join the fight by visiting demandjustice.org/kick. That's demandjustice.org/kick. How did you first get into the theater? From what I can recall, you didn't exactly come from a big theater family, did you?
No, no one in my life was involved in show business at all. We were from Jersey City. I had two older brothers, Bob and Dan, and my oldest brother, Dan, is the one who really introduced me to the theater. He encouraged me to read a great deal, and then also took me to the theater, took me to see plays in New York, Broadway and off-Broadway. He volunteered my services for a play that friends of his were doing in college because they needed a child in one scene, and so that was my first time stepping onto a stage. What was in this college production of a play by Frank Gilroy called Who'll Save the Plowboy? Not a great title. Yeah. This is the man who wrote The Subject Was Roses, but he wrote this. There was a play he wrote called Who'll Save the Plowboy? And they needed a child in this somewhere in the second act. And that the first time I was brought on stage. So it was really my brother who encouraged that. My father had died when I was very young, when I was 11. And my brother, Danny, I think, felt, he needed to be a father figure, a mentor in that way. And so he certainly was a big part of encouraging my love of reading and of the theater.
And what was your first big break? Was that Present Laughter or what?
Well, on Broadway, mm-hmm. Yes, that was my Broadway debut with the great George C. Scott.
Yeah.
In 1982, I believe, at Circle in the Square Theater. Yeah. I had done a television series with Mickey Rooney and Dana Carvey called One of the Boys. I had been in Los Angeles, and then I came back to New York to do the series, and then I knew it was not going to last very long. And then we did 13 episodes and finished. And then I auditioned for this revival of the Noel Coward play, yeah. Present Laughter, and that George C. Scott, surprisingly, was not that he was, it wasn't surprising that he was directing it, but that he was starring in it as well in the Noel Coward role. So there was unusual casting, but he was a brilliant comic actor as well as a dramatic actor. And it was a big sort of surprise hit for me. That was a huge thing.
Yeah, I'm trying to picture him in that role. That's interesting.
Well, it was more along the lines of a John Barrymore than a sort of aging Noel Coward matinee idol. It was more in the John Barrymore family, but he was wonderful in it. I mean, really hilarious and very touching too at times.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what the line was from that show. It's on no prayer, no bribe, no threat, no power will induce me to go to Africa with Burl Willard, and no goddamn son of a bitch ever won a war by dying for his country. I immediately go into Patton anytime I try to picture George C. Scott in the role.
Well, he was the only person I know who could make the word darling sound like a command. The character had to say darling. And you would sort of jump to attention when he said it. Darling.
Now, Nathan, before we talk about Penny Dreadful, I have to bring up perhaps
have to talk about Penny Dreadful.
I have to bring
it's
up
very important.
Yes. I have to bring up your role in one of the all-time great Broadway shows. I would say it's right up there with Oklahoma, My Fair Lady, West Side Story, all the classics. You were in the legendary musical Merlin, starring, of all people, Doug Henning.
Doug Henning. Remember Doug Henning?
Yes.
Well, you have a good memory. Yes, he was a very popular magician, or as he liked to be called, an illusionist. It's an illusion. He was very popular and in the 70s, and previously had done a musical called The Magic Show, written by Stephen Schwartz, that was a big hit.
Oh, right. I forgot about that.
So someone, in their infinite wisdom, decided he should be in a real book musical where there was he played a character, and in this case he was playing young Merlin. And then it was written by the gentleman who wrote like Columbo, Richard Levinson and Bill Link.
Perfect.
Who were talented. They had done a lot of successful television, but yeah. Had never written the book to a musical before. And then it was directed by a gentleman from the RSC, Frank Dunlop, a British director, who eventually left. Everyone eventually left. yes, Merlin, it was billed as Merlin, the magical musical to the entire family. And Cheetah Rivera, the great legendary Cheetah Rivera, played... she had no name. She was just called the Evil Queen. And I played her idiot son, Prince Fergus. And she wanted me to become King of England, and she was going to do anything to stop Merlin from helping young Arthur, ascend the throne. I think that was vaguely the plot.
Wow.
Although, you know, Doug, who was he was a very talented magician, was not really an actor or a singer or a dancer, but here he was starring in the middle of this big, very expensive, especially for the time, Broadway musical. And he couldn't, for example, he couldn't do an English accent. So he was from Canada. So they said, well, since Doug can't do an accent, you shouldn't do an accent. So it seemed to be taking place somewhere outside of Ottawa. And but we had all sorts of there were animals and, you know, from his magic act, they tried to build the show around all of these magic tricks and also tried to create a real book musical.
Yeah.
And it didn't really work. Yeah. And I was sort of the comic relief. But, you know, my memory is just the joy of getting to work with Cheetah Rivera.
Oh, yeah.
And I do remember Doug Henning. He told me a story once. He was a lovely man. And he said, he told me the story of opening night. He had an opening night in Vegas, and there were many, many stars there that night. And the end of his act, the finish to his big act, he and his wife Debbie worked together, and he would turn his wife Debbie into a white Bengal tiger. That was the big finish. And so Debbie had disappeared, and there's a pedestal, and there's a white Bengal tiger sitting on it, and the audience is cheering, and he's taking a bow, and he looks over, and he sees the chain that is usually attached to the pedestal is swinging back and forth underneath the tiger's mouth. And he looks at the tiger, and this all happened in a matter of seconds, like 30 seconds. And the tiger is looking at the audience, and like a buffet, and starts to walk off the pedestal and head towards the audience.
Oh, God.
And the audience starts to panic and scream. And Doug, who weighed about 98 pounds soaking wet, ran and grabbed the chain and started to try to pull the tiger back. Okay. And the tiger was surprised by this, turned and swatted him with his paw, and Doug fell back. And the next thing he knew, he said the tiger was on top of him and was licking his entire face up to his hairline. And he realized this isn't affection. He's cleaning his prey, because he then took his entire, he had a little head. He took his entire head into his mouth, and he said, I felt his teeth going into my neck. And he said, luckily, I passed out. And because I fainted, he said, my body went limp. The tiger opened his mouth to look what happened. And by that time, the trainer had gotten to him and pulled him off. And he said, the next thing I knew, I woke up in the dressing room. I was on a bed. And he said, I looked up, and Bob Hope, of all people, was standing over me. What? And he said, kid, that's the greatest finish I've ever seen. There's a little show business story for you.
I mean, you got animals, you've got a score written by film composer Elmer Bernstein, known for such musical romps as Cape Fear.
he was a lovely man. Yes. Elmer Bernstein, right. Don Black, yeah. Or Don, who wrote Born Free.
What could go wrong?
Academy Award winner. What could go wrong? What could possibly go wrong? We were in previews for months, longer than any other show in the history of Broadway. When we opened, people thought it was a revival.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much the plot to The Producers, I think. I wonder if there were some nefarious machinations in the background with the producers of the show.
Yeah, that it was a tax loss for someone.
Exactly. Well, yeah. Let's talk about Benny Dreadful. This is an interesting role for you. You actually play an LAPD detective who is straight and Jewish.
I'm Jewish.
What can you tell us about him?
Well, this came about because the brilliant writer, John Logan, sent me an email and said, I wrote this part for you and I hope you'll do it. He sent me the first episode, and I was just knocked out and thrilled and gratified that he would think of me for this, because I thought not many people in Hollywood would cast me in this particular role. But John, who I know a bit from New York theater, he said he had seen me in The Iceman Cometh and thought, this is who I think should play this part. So he's Louis Michener is a grizzled old Jewish detective on the LAPD in 1938. He's seen it all. It's very much your classic hard-boiled detective, but he's a complicated fella. And he has partnered with this young Mexican, who is the first Mexican detective on the force, this character, Tiago Vega, played by a fantastic young actor named Danny Zavato. And he has partnered with him, really, because no one else would partner with him. And I think he also understands what it is to be an outsider, being a Jew. And he's becomes his sort of father figure and mentor. He's estranged from his own children. His wife has died. So, and I think he hopes to get it right with this young man, that he could hopefully be a better father to him than he was to his own children. And so it creates a real bond between them, especially as the episodes go on and it gets more and more complex. But it's a wonderful character. It's certainly the most interesting and emotionally complex character that I've ever played.
Oh, really?
In film or television.
Yeah, because people know you from comedies a lot of times, but, you know, it must have been fun to play someone who, for once, isn't a laugh riot. I mean, he kind of has some gallows humor to him, but he also sort of has a dark, cynical view.
Oh, yes. Yeah, he has a kind of sardonic sense of humor. He's one of the few. It's a serious show. He's one of the few people who does sort of have a very dark sense of humor. But that's sort of in the Raymond Chandler tradition. Yeah, and look, yes, for people who, if you only know me from something like Modern Family, mm-hmm. yes, this will be a revelation. if like you, and you very kindly have followed a lot of my work in the theater, then it won't be as quite a revelation, but it's very exciting for me.
Yeah.
Look, I had a stunt double. It was so exciting.
Was that a first for you?
No, absolutely. And you know, I pistol whipping kids, dragging them to the edge of a cliff, and then stepping on their faces. I had the time of my life.
Yeah.
It's great fun, and it's really terrific and challenging material.
Yeah, it's an interesting through line from this new season to the original seasons, because Penny Dreadful, City of Angels has this heavy influence from pulp crime and detective novels of the 30s and 40s, which are in a way the natural successor of the old Victorian era Penny Dreadfuls. Are you a fan of all of the old Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett, Gumshoes, and L.A. noir films like Big Sleep, Chinatown, L.A. Confidential, those things?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's funny. I went back to read The Big Sleep when I was in L.A. Filming this. And you just marvel at Chandler's language and humor. And that there's a whole story in his life that is fascinating. And he lived all over Los Angeles. Really, how we know Los Angeles, a lot of that comes from Raymond Chandler. Mm-hmm. The whole feel and the writing is just spectacular. He was such an original. So let's just say this Penny Dreadful has nothing to do with the old Penny Dreadful. Yeah. We have a great deal of respect for the old Penny Dreadful, and it had a very voracious fan base that loved it and loved Eva Green. This has nothing to do with it, and this is not a continuation in any way. We must think of Penny Dreadful as an anthology title.
Yes.
Not unlike American Crime Story or American Horror Story.
Right.
This is Raymond Chandler meets Rod Serling. So there is a supernatural element to it that is tied into Mexican folklore,
right.
But it has nothing to do with taking characters from Gothic literature and mixing them all together.
Right. For what it's worth, Nathan, I was a fan of the original show, and I really like where you guys are going with this new version, this new anthology series that you've created here. So,
it's John. You know, this is all John Logan. This is kind of, you know, I don't, I hate to turn it into something political, but it is, he did write it in response, and he's talked about this, publicly at the TCA press day. And he said, this was a reaction to what was going on right now in the country. Mm-hmm. There are those socio-political elements to it. And yet it is a thrilling yarn he has created. And in this case, the monsters that people might remember fondly from the original, it's about the monsters inside all of us. And how easy it is for people to get in touch with the dark side, and it's really more about the human story, I think, than that the kind of thing that happened the first time around. And I think it's a really great and compelling story, and it's an enormous tapestry. There are so many different worlds. It takes a few episodes for you to start to see how all of that intertwines. And I think people will find it very intriguing.
And elements of the show are inspired by real events in L.A. during that time. As a New Yorker, did you know much about the dark history of L.A. in that era?
I did not. I was sort of aware of, of the Nazi infiltration of LA, yeah. but not to the degree that I realized when I started doing research and reading all these books about what was happening at the time, because my character, Louis Michener, is, aside from the central murder mystery that he and his partner are trying to solve, there is he is working on this the fact that there's all of these Nazi groups in LA, and investigating them, and one particular guy who is played by the wonderful German actor Thomas Kretschmann. All of that is you just can't believe what was going on and how prevalent it was. Mm-hmm. And there were just, you know, this huge place called the Deutsche Haus where there were meetings and rallies, and there was a camp in Topanga where they were starting a militia group. There was the Silver Shirts who were an offshoot of the Brown Shirts. There was, you know, obviously there was the Ku Klux Klan. This was part of the storyline, was inspired by this brilliant Jewish lawyer, Leon Lewis, who formed a spy ring to investigate these organizations.
Really?
And foiled countless assassinations and killings and bombings. And he was a true American hero. And without him, we could easily all be speaking German.
Yeah.
It is unbelievable what he was able to put an end to. But without the help, really, of the local police, who told him, you know, they weren't interested, and the government, who said, you know, we're not worried about Nazis, it's communists. And so eventually he went to all of the studio heads who were Jewish, and gathered them at the Hillcrest Country Club and said, listen, my law firm is failing because I'm spending all this time running this spy network, and here is all this information, and I need some financial assistance to keep this going, because, you know, these people are liable to, you know, come to your neighborhood. And, you know, he foiled it. They wanted to kill many famous people that were on a list. It's extraordinary when you start to see the extent of it.
That's incredible. And I never knew that story.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So, so that is a part of the storyline, and and it gets more and more complex as it goes on. I guess I shouldn't reveal too many.
Oh yeah. Let's leave some mystery here. And, but the show does assert that Hitler had big designs on LA as some kind of sun-drenched Nazi utopia. And I do understand that there may have been some basis for that, huh?
Oh, that's absolutely true. He absolutely wanted it as a base of operations, and mainly because of the film community, because he wanted access to all of that.
Incredible.
Yeah, totally true.
The show is just terrific, Nathan. Before we go, I know that you had a long friendship and working relationship with the late, great playwright Terrence McNally, who just died of coronavirus complications, I think, 3 weeks ago. Do you want to say a few words about him before we go?
Look, he was the theater world, and the world in general, lost a giant, a major playwright and a groundbreaker in Terrence. And for myself personally, I lost one of my closest and dearest friends, and someone who certainly championed me very early in my career, and who really gave me some of the best and most important roles in the theater. And I would not have had a career without him, and giving me those opportunities and wanting to collaborate that way. And I've been in New York for 11 years at that point, but it was really when I did the first play I did of his, called The Lisbon Traviata, was the thing that really kind of put me on the map and changed everything. So it was a collaboration of really close to over 30 years. But the last thing we did was this revival of a play of his called It's Only a Play on Broadway, which was a great success. And he was a monumental part of my life, and certainly a monumental part of the gay community. And he was writing about gay issues way before other people, starting with his Broadway debut with a play called And Things That Go Bump in the Night. He was just a wonderful, wonderful friend. It was a devastating loss.
Great talent, and he will definitely be missed. What a loss. Yes. Well, again, on the lighter side, I loved you in Producers. What's more?
Thanks, Ben. I appreciate that. I appreciate your kindness and generosity.
Absolutely. Yeah. Once more, look for Nathan Lane in Penny Dreadful, City of Angels, premiering Sunday, April 26th at 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific, only on Showtime. Nathan Lane, it was a total delight. Thank you.
Same here, Ben. Thank you. Take care. Stay safe and healthy.
You too. Thanks again to Nathan Lane for coming on the show. Look for Nathan in Penny Dreadful, City of Angels, premiering Sunday, April 26th at 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific on Showtime. For more information, visit Showtime.com. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.